Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Karma Seminar, Questions and Answers, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhiyada Velayada Swami.
Rohan Temple, looking more complete. Okay, did we scare anyone away? Anyone here yesterday who didn't come back? I notice no one sitting up front. Brave souls over there. Okay, third question. I've come across Hindu texts such as Yoga Vasishtha that says that by effort one can overcome his karma. The Quran in verse 371 says, when destiny ordains wealth, it gives birth to industriousness. When it decrees a life of loss, it inspires only idleness. Again, I am wondering, does one have the freedom and ability to overcome or lessen the effects of his karma? For example, if a person has read about Guru Dev's teachings, is he then able to control his thoughts and the way he reacts to situations? Isn't the fact that he had the opportunity to read about Gurudeva's teachings his karma? In contrast, someone else is in a similar situation, but according to his karma, was not exposed to such teachings. Isn't there already an inherent limitation based on karma? Discussion. What do you think? The question is this quote from the Quran. It's saying that when we're successful, we tend to be industrious, and when we're not successful, we tend to be not industrious. Can we overcome that, or is it just up to our karma?
Yeah.
Okay, that's a very good point. We have a choice in how we respond. Okay. Yeah.
If I can just add to that, then how you respond depends on how spiritually mature you are.
Mm-hmm.
So at the point of evolution of that particular soul, you know, would depend on how he or she reacts to experiences.
Anything else? Yes.
One can use his willpower to do superconscious things to keep his awareness moving forward and upward.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we had an interesting example of that, fortunately, a long time ago. 1992 was our last hurricane. But it was a strong one. Blew away a lot of people's homes, and we were without power for 2 or 3 months. How people reacted was very interesting. Some individuals had no choice but to leave the island. It just upset them so, particularly if their home was damaged. And the only reaction they could muster up was to leave and regroup somewhere else. They weren't able to face the situation here. Others, it brought some people closer together because they were sharing resources and all. Mm-hmm. Totally different reactions. So you can see in extreme situations like that, it brings out different aspects of people according to kind of emotional control and kind of spiritual maturity they have. It doesn't bring out the same reaction in everyone, which is what the Kural quote would say, everybody would react the same. Yes. Again, I think. Okay, so let's take a look at our answer to question 3. Your answer. So the crawl quote is indicating a tendency, human nature, that when things are going well, it's easy to be industrious, but when they're not, it's easy to slack off. So it's human nature that way. But spiritual evolution, desire, develop knowledge, carry over from past lives, as well as prarabdha karma carries over. But this is bringing in current influences as well. In other words, it's one thing when you talk about childhood reactions, which was the first question, you don't have a lot of input from this life to work with when you're very young. You're definitely carrying over from past lives and you're reacting to your family. But when you're an adult, you've had the opportunity for current life influences as well. So as it says, we also have influences from the present life as additional influences. We just looked at the one about worship, but other influences are coming up here. An important way that our present life influences karma is that all our actions in the present are creating what we experience in the future, even in future lives. The point here is that when we think of karma, we tend to think of the past. We reflect upon the rewards and punishments from the past that are yet to manifest, and what we must have done to create them. However, we must also think about our future in this life and lives to come. Our actions in the present are influencing the future, making it a pleasant or unpleasant one. Therefore, before acting, a wise person reflects on the actions, karmic consequences, and thereby consciously molds his future. So that's there to introduce the next point. We all know this idea. A second related concept is the idea of affirmations. The idea behind affirmations is that through the repetition of positive statements, we can improve our self-concept, make greater progress on the spiritual path, and, in general, increase our magnetism to success. Gurudeva elucidates the basis for affirmations in the Cognizant Ability resource in the back of his book, Merging with Shiva. The future is created by the impressions we have put into the subconscious in the past, and those impressions we are placing there in the present. Many impressions that go into the subconscious mind are the actions of our life and our reactions to these actions, both of which shape the future experiences we have in a haphazard way. Affirmations, on the other hand, are carefully chosen impressions we are deliberately placing in our subconscious to produce specific results in the future. So the idea is, what goes into our subconscious creates the future. Be it actions, and those have reactions. Be it affirmations, you know, whatever we put into the subconscious mind, that's where the future comes from, and that carries forward from one life to the next. So the idea is, just as karma carries forward and is a result of what we've done, through the subconscious, we can use the subconscious through affirmations to change what happens to us. In other words, we're attracting our future based upon what's in our subconscious mind. And we can deliberately harness that future better by the use of affirmations. For example, I was talking to Hindu woman, her son had been working in Singapore and was laid off. This was in 2009. He was in the financial industry and she was worried about his having a job. So what benefit is worry? If we worry all the the time about something for ourselves or something for somebody else, we're putting that impression into the subconscious, right? Because whatever we think about on a repetitive basis is what's going in the mind in the strongest way. So if it's worry, what does worry do? You can create what you're worried about. Yes, that's the worst side of it. Worry about something enough to be attracted to. But in this case, what good does it do the mother to worry about her son getting a job? Does it do any good?
No.
No, in fact, it's a negative influence to some degree. Because all our thoughts, when we think about somebody else, that thought goes to the other person. Be it a positive, a negative, or a neutral thought. If we're thinking about somebody else, our thought hits the other person. If they're sensitive, they'll feel it. There's a quote in words of our master, Yoga Swami says something like, thousands of thoughts are coming to me, something like that. He's aware of everyone who's thinking about it, because his own mind is so quiet. And he knows how to do that. You can tell where the thought came from if you're good at that. But that's a different subject. So our thoughts go out to other people. So if they're worrisome, it's a negative thought to some degree. Well, I explained, it's better to create a visualization, positive visualization of your son finding a job, and think about that. Now that's more helpful. But still, it's in her mind, it's not in his mind. So what we try and do to help someone else is much less effective than what the person, him or herself, tries to do. In other words, to really manifest something in a dynamic way, you need to visualize it yourself. You can't visualize it for someone else. They need to do the visualization because it's their subconscious which is attracting life to them. It's not your subconscious which is attracting life to them. You're sending a positive thought, and that positive thought helps them to some degree, but if they want to do an affirmation, then they do it themselves. So an affirmation is making use of this principle that whatever goes into the subconscious mind, that's where the future comes from. So when we use affirmations, we can mold the subconscious mind over a period of years. It doesn't take lifetimes. We can mold the subconscious over a period of years, and therefore the tendencies we had have been changed in a positive way. We're more positive. So if we were tending this way, when life is difficult, we tend to slack off. If we had that tendency, we can get rid of it by affirmation. We don't have to remain the same. So not only are we influenced by these different aspects of our past besides karma, we're influenced by what we put into the subconscious mind in this life as well. And it's very important for those who are parents to watch out for the self-image. The self-image, could call it a positive self-concept. One's self-concept is a crucial factor in how we respond to life, how we look at ourselves. By what our parents told us and by what our teachers told us, do we think of ourselves as talented and as good as everybody else, or do we think of ourselves as flawed and less than everybody else? So we want to think of ourselves as talented and as good as everybody else. Not superior, I'm not trying to create a big ego, but we don't want to feel inferior. You know? And that's controlled by how we raise a child, how we discipline a child. All of that relates to the self-image. And a few of you haven't heard this, so I'll say it, though many of you have. We distinguish between the behavior and the person. You never say, oh, you're stupid. What a stupid thing to do. You're putting the wrong image in the child's mind that he or she is stupid. So you want to distinguish the behavior from the person. You say, that was a very stupid thing to do, but you're so smart, I'm sure you'll never do it again. Oh, the child is smart, the behavior was stupid. It's a very subtle point, but an important point. And you want to watch that self-image and create a positive self-concept. And raising children is the first of nine qualities we want to develop in children, but it's the most important one. Because if that's not there, then the others are harder to develop. But they're in the armature of the nine qualities. So this one relates to affirmations. And we can see the answer is that even if that was our tendency because of past life experiences, we can change it through what we do in this life. And affirmations is just one example. We could find other examples as well. But we can change who we are coming into this life by consciously using principles such as affirmations. Okay, that's number three. And questions on that? That's pretty straightforward, I think. More so than some of the other ones. Okay, question number four. Does our Prarabdha Karma only create situations for us, or does it also influence our thinking? It is said that karma only impels but does not compel. I've noticed that sometimes one is compelled to react in a certain manner by his instincts, and only years later he realizes the mistake. Then again, can one's karma compel a person to react in a certain way? What do you think? Discussion. Is it karma or something else that is compelling a person to react in a certain way? Or what is it that compels us to react as we do?
Instinctive mind,
yes, that's part of it.
Astrology,
okay.
Spiritual maturity.
Mm-hmm. Spiritual maturity.
Personal experience.
Yes, those are all good.
Where you're flowing your awareness.
Yes. Okay, well.
Training that we have received, like examples from our parents.
Mm-hmm. Yes, training. Well, training is the one that's the closest to the answer we're giving. The answer we're giving, all the answers you've given are correct, but we're looking at a specific one here. Fourth answer. But quite often, this is a factor. Belief and attitude. Our beliefs create our attitudes. Our attitudes are the basis upon which we act. So you take, for example, what do you do to create a terrorist?
Still belief.
You have to change the beliefs. Yes, you have to, and that's what happens first. You watch how someone becomes a terrorist, they show it sometimes on television, this or that. They put a lot of energy into lecturing them. You know, they go places and listen to lectures and change the belief structure that they have in a serious way. And of course it helps if the person is dissatisfied in some way, you know, doesn't have employment or is poor or whatever, you know, isn't happy with the current life, but that's not enough to create a terrorist. You have to create the belief structure of a terrorist. Likewise, someone like Martin Luther King, he had to change the beliefs of some of the people that worked with him because they weren't naturally nonviolent. <You know? laughs> Other way around. And reason with them. What'll happen if we're violent? And talk to them and show them the benefit of a belief of changing society through nonviolent methods. So let's see what Gurudeva says here. Every belief creates certain attitudes. Attitudes govern our actions. Our actions can thus be traced to our inmost beliefs about ourselves and the world around us. Belief in karma, reincarnation, and the existence of all-pervasive divinity throughout the universe creates an attitude of reverence, benevolence, and compassion for all beings. The natural consequence of this belief is ahimsa, non-hurtfulness. We can see how practicing ahimsa is based upon a number of beliefs, not even just one. And, you know, definitely the what's coming up, I have to be careful about. Giveaway is coming up, and then I can't read. However, if our beliefs are erroneous, our actions will not be in tune with the universal Dharma. For instance, the beliefs in the duality of self and other, of eternal heaven and hell, victors and vanquished, white forces and dark forces, create the attitudes that we must be on guard and are justified in giving injury, physically, mentally, and emotionally, to those whom we judge as bad, pagan, alien, or unworthy. Such thinking leads to rationalizing so-called righteous wars and conflicts. As long as our beliefs are dualistic, we will continue to generate antagonism, and that will erupt here and there in violence. So that was very interesting when our former President Bush, I like to use this phrase, the excess of evil, you know. Cringe every time I heard it. Wait a minute. We don't believe that. You know, you can't label North Koreans evil just because they have a different belief system than we do. You know, they believe differently, but that doesn't make them evil. They're just different. And those beliefs can be changed over time. Beliefs are malleable. So everyone, as we know, we talked about it in the Sun One talk, that everyone is intrinsically a divine being. So evil doesn't relate to who anyone is. It relates to actions. If we're going to label someone evil, it's because their actions are inappropriate for the society in which they're in. They're not acting as they're supposed to. Therefore, they're considered evil. But they're still a divine being. And the duty of religious people, such as all of us, to see everyone improving. We even want those who don't like us to improve. We want everyone to improve. You know, it's like being the judge in the criminal law system. You're not trying to punish people because they're evil. You're trying to punish them so they improve their behavior. You're trying to motivate them to finally catch on. But you can't go around robbing banks. You know, there are consequences. You're not supposed to do it, so we have this little punishment here every time you do. So eventually, you're hoping they'll catch on and stop doing it. You're wanting them to improve their behavior. You're not condemning them. They're bad. You're good. They're bad. No, you want them to improve so that their behavior conforms to the society. So that's the way knowledgeable Hindus should look at everyone. We want the whole world to improve. We don't leave anybody out. Well, that's the belief. Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, the whole world is family. We don't leave anybody out because they're of a different religion, a different ethnicity, a different nationality. No, we have to include everybody in our desire for people to be happy and peaceful. And the prayer goes on, even the four-legged, not just the two-legged. Even the animals are supposed to be included. Some beautiful peace prayers. So we're including everybody, everything. Okay, so you can see I jumped ahead to the nine qualities here. I already just told you this. So anyway, the belief that is the core one is belief about ourself, the self-concept. And the important thing is the self-concept can be changed. If as an adult, on reflection, we find our self-concept isn't as good as it should be, we can change it. See if it says how to do so here. Yes, it's coming up. Okay, stay tuned. One self-concept can be changed through reading teachings, such as Gurudeva's, where he stresses you are a divine being, superconscious being. He says we have to adjust our subconscious to the idea that we are a superconscious being rather than an instinctive being or an intellectual being driven by the impulses of the five senses. Awareness is the core of us. If we dropped off this physical body today, we would be a superconscious being without a physical body. So that's a very important concept, where we are a divine being. And when you look at Dancing with Shiva, a book about Shiva, you would think the first sloka would be about Shiva, right? If you hadn't seen it. Gurudev is going to start telling me about Shiva. Shiva's this, Shiva's this, but he doesn't. How does he start? Yes, you are a divine being, coming from God, returning to God, this and that. You know, start with you. You are a divine being. So he doesn't start talking about God, Shiva, he starts talking about you. And you're a divinity. So it shows how important it is in the overall structure. And you can't think of yourself as a divine being if you have a negative self-concept. There's no way. You're not even a good human being, let alone a divine being. I'm a worthless human being. How could I be a divine being? Too big a jump, right? So that's why the positive self-concept is so important. And as I say, it's a lot of it doesn't all come from how you're raised. It comes from past lives, some of it. But a lot of that is the exposure we have in our younger years. So reading Gurudeva's teachings can help us change our core belief, who we are. And then, as we've been talking about, another way to change concepts is through affirmations. We actually change the structure of the subconscious mind. And life responds differently to us. I'll put in the related point because we may not get to it. It's in the question we're going to do last at this time. Well, let's stop the clock here. 12 minutes. It's the New Age approach to affirmations. How many of you have seen that kind of thing? You know, The Secret or Visualize, Materialize. So the point obviously is the same, but it's being presented without certain subtleties, shall we say. You know, and the point is correct, not challenging the point. But it gives the impression that everybody's equal in this ability. That everyone in this room, for example, could visualize the same thing and materialize the same thing. That we have it's an inherent ability we all have, so let's just use it. We all have the same ability. But that's ignoring karma. That's ignoring past lives. It's setting aside the fact that some of us have had more past lives than others. We've done different things in past lives. We have different carry forward from the past. We have different karmas in this life. Some are destined to be quite wealthy. Some are destined not to be wealthy. Just from the astrology, you can see that. So it's ignoring all that subtlety, all the inherent differences we have, and making it look like everybody's the same. So that's misleading. It's also making it look like you can fix everything. You can fix disease, you can fix all disease just by visualization. Well, some diseases can't be fixed by anything. You know, they're just incurable. And visualization can help with disease, but you know, it's not a miracle. Doesn't rebuild the physical body. You know, it's not a siddha. It's just a power to for the mind to influence matter to some degree. But it's not a cure-all for everything. But so it's an important point that I wanted to throw out there. And, you know, that,
that's very well said. You know, I see that stuff, mm-hmm. and you know, something is askew. I never nailed it down the way you just said. Mm-hmm. That's very good. And it doesn't change the core identity at all. It just goes to, oh, whatever you want, just visualize it. Or you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They leave the whole foundation behind, kind of.
Well, yes, it's making
very,
it... It's too simplified. You know, the principle is good, and we're not speaking against it, but,
right.
you know, it's too simplified. And there's more to it than that, and there's limitations that aren't being acknowledged, and more importantly, there's differences between individuals. So just because someone else was successful at it doesn't mean you'll be successful at it to the same extent. But they would present it that way. Well, if this person could do it, you could do it. But, you know, just like everyone can't be a great athlete, you know, we know we're different, right? Just because someone runs the, you know, I think in terms of a mile, if someone runs the mile in less than 4 minutes, that used to be good when I was growing up. Just because someone could do that doesn't mean we can all do it, even with training. Our physical bodies are different, right? We know that. So we don't all fall in. But in this case, there's differences and they're not being acknowledged in terms of karma, in terms of past life experience, and so forth, in terms of our prarabdha karmas, what we're going to experience in this life anyway. Those are all differentiating factors. In that. So that relates to the question on health, which, as I say, we'll do that one last, if there's time. Can you stop? Okay, this is, it's not a question, it's just a discussion there. We need to make these headings better. But turn the question page over at the top. It's the false concept about karma, and it's really strong in Asia. I don't think it's strong in the U.S. yet. My life is in a state of chaos. Everything is going wrong, and it all started 3 months ago when Saturn entered Taurus. And my karma changed. I have been advised that if I can successfully appease Saturn, Sani, through having a priest do regular Sani puja, my problems will go away. How many of you are familiar with that issue?
I did.
Okay, about half. So this is very large-scale phenomena in Asia, and part of it is that the astrologer is quite often the priest. We call it double dipping. he's got two salaries going here. He can tell you the problem and how to solve it, and then he can be the one who solves it for you. So.
Your financial consultant as your stockbroker, buddy.
Right, exactly. You know, the same thing. You get this where somehow what you recommend is exactly the service you provide, wearing another hat. You know. Okay, so if someone told you about this, what would you suggest? Yeah.
I would suggest that they take Bodhinatha's karma management
seminar. And what does it say?
It tells the real nature of karma and how mm-hmm. it can be mitigated.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, yes, the point it makes is that in this approach, what's the problem?
Putting the influence, or, you know,
mm-hmm, right,
maybe not something else.
Sani is causing me a problem.
Instead of understanding.
Yesterday it wasn't, now today it's Sani is causing me a problem.
Blaming it on someone else.
Well, you know, it's like saying, you know, when you're grounded, my parents are causing a problem. You know, it's not looking backwards to what caused them to ground you, you know. The parents, they're causing me all this grief. Did you do something? Oh, no, no, I didn't do anything. It's just they arbitrarily grounded me. So, yes, it's pointing the finger at Sani, and as we know from the analogy to the seeds, that different seeds, different prarabdha karmas manifest under different astrological conditions. But you created the seed, right? Sani didn't create the seed. It's like putting seeds in the ground in the winter that'll sprout in the summer, and next, you know, summer you come out and they're sprouting, and you say, well, why are they sprouting? You know, and you put them there previously. So it's, you did something in a past life, it created a reaction, a prarabdha karma, that you're facing in this life, and you're blaming Sani. So that's the problem. Any other suggestions on what you would say to someone if they asked you about this?
Well, they need to take responsibility. Mm-hmm. Say, this is me. This is not a stone mm-hmm. out there. This is something I can do, and take responsibility and have a plan mm-hmm. to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good.
Does it, like say, you know, in the astrology, a planet enters one of your houses and it brings up that seed karma.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you face the karma, but, and hopefully you get, you know, you do all the right things so it doesn't mm-hmm. come around again. But it does it lighten up as the energies go different into a different house?
Oh, of course.
It changes, but it'll come back around. Mm-hmm.
That's the nice thing about the astrology, is it doesn't put all of the bad things in one part of your life. It spreads them out. You know, it's like all the cold days in your life aren't back to back. Because time is circular. You know.
So even if you don't resolve it or get through it, it'll lighten up and it'll go away and it'll come back around?
No, it won't come back.
It won't come back?
No, the similar things will come back, but not that particular one. That one is, unless you react to it, that's gone. If you react to it, then you're creating, you're making it come back in some form, but, you know, in a future life, usually. But it happens. You know, say your house gets foreclosed upon unfairly, and you lose your house. It happened. So, you know, as long as you don't do something unfair as a result, then it's gone. That karma's gone. Okay, well, let's see what the answer says here. Answer to discussion of Sani. So there's my story. I can tell my story, I remember. This is what really put it in my mind. The real life story. I was staying in downtown Malaysia a long time ago. And somehow this young man was told I was there, so he came up to see me, and 25 or 30 year old, and single, living out of town, so every day he would commute in, work long hours, and then commute back. So he didn't have much free time. And he had a Sani problem, and the priest had told him, well, what you should do is on Saturday, because that's Sani's day, Saturday, and you should go to the temple and worship Sani. Do Sani Puja on Saturday. So that's what he was doing. But that's all he was doing. His only worship was to Sani on Saturday. He didn't have any worship throughout the week. You know, he didn't have time for much. So the one worship slot he had was filled up with Sani. And I thought about that. I said, that's not right. You know, we're not on a campaign to say that no one should ever worship Sani. You know, that's not Gurudeva's style, to try and go out and change the entire Hindu world on something. But when it comes to you in that form, then you need to say something. Mm-hmm. So the point is, the person's religious life was out of balance to give all his attention to Sani and no attention to a normal deity, Shiva, Vishnu, you know, in the sense of worship. So, but that was the advice he received. So you can see that it's problematic and not really traditional. It's not really traditional to give all your attention to one of the nine planets. So we have an excellent answer from Dr. K. Ganesha Lingam, which outlines Saivism. Most of the temples nowadays have Navagrahams, or nine planets, in their premises. These are not found in the ancient temples. According to Saivism and even astrology, planets do not create events. They only indicate events which affect us according to our past karma. So far, so good, right? Shows we're not alone in our opinion here. To overcome the problems of life and to gain mental strength to face them, we should worship God, who is the indweller even in planets and causing their movements. Isn't that powerful?
Yeah.
Giving a higher place than God to a planet and worshiping it is born out of ignorance. Hiriyana Samandar, Murti Nayanar. Okay, what do we have here? Kolaru Patigam, okay. It's a famous song. Says that the Navagrahas indicate good to Shiva's devotees. By singing his Kolaru Patigam verses and praying to Shiva, the evil effects indicated by planets will be removed. So there's a nice story here. I'll just read it because I don't tell it enough to tell it spontaneously. So, 7th century Tamil Nadu, Jainism was on the rise in the Pandya kingdom. Very easy for a religion to be on the rise, it just means the king becomes of that religion. But everybody else is supposed to. And then the king becomes Saivite again, everybody else is supposed to, the king becomes Buddhist. You know, it was happening at that time. Not so much Buddhist, I think, but Jainism was very strong in South India. That's how Saivism got into places, you know, that Saivism would go to Indonesia and they convert the local kings and then all their followers would become Saivites. It just took convincing one person. So the king is a Jain. There was a lot of discrimination against Saivites. The queen, okay, Mangayar Karasiyar, and the chief minister, Kulachirayar, were perturbed by these. They learned about the greatness of Chiruyana Sambandar and felt that he could show the right path to the Pandya king. Hence they sent a message to Chiruyana Sambandar explaining the situation and requested him to visit Madurai. When the request came, Chiruyana Sambandar was with Tirunavakarasu. In Tiruvengaru, Sambandar was only 7 years old at the time, agreed and decided to go to Madurai. So he was only 7 years old when he sang this song. Amazing, you know, he's just, some, you know, I mean, where does that come from in a past life, right? 7 year-old who's wiser than a 70-year-old. So, of course, Tirunavakarasu was protective. Had been persecuted by the Jains in the past. He felt that Sambandar, being a very young boy, was vulnerable to being harmed. Further, he concluded that astrologically it was not an auspicious period for Sambandar to undertake this venture. Hence, he tried to dissuade Sambandar from going to Madurai. Sambandar responded to Tirunavakarasu that no harm will come to an ardent Siva devotee like him. He then sang Kolaru Patigam. The song's title can be translated as removing the negative effects of the planets. That's what it means. So, the first verse, these capitals and all, it's just it's a way of transliterating Tamil. Being, meaning Shiva, who has as his equal half the woman, the Umai of bamboo-like frame, has implanted himself within me in the archetypal forms as the one who plays the faultless Veena and as the one wearing the pure half moon and the Ganges on his tuft. And because of this, for devout people like me, the forces of the Sun, Moon, Mars, Mercury, Jupiter, Venus, Saturn, and the snakes, Rahu and Ketu, will not do anything evil, but only good, the really good. Oh, what is he saying there? It's hard to sort it out if you haven't seen the verse before. He's telling, of course, we don't pray to the planet itself to remove its evil effects, but rather we pray to Shiva. Our prayers should be to Shiva, and if our prayers are to Shiva, if we're really devoted to Shiva, then nothing can harm us. That's what it's saying. So, of course, in our tradition, you know, back in those days, everything was Shiva, but we have Ganesha and Muruga too. So we can pray to them as well. So that's the idea. And very, very nicely said by the Dr. Ganesha Lingam. He says it just like we would, right? You know, if I showed you that and said, did Gurudeva write that? You'd say, oh sure, Gurudeva wrote that. That's Gurudeva's teachings. But of course he didn't. But it's, you know, it's an important point that someone who understands the tradition, as he's a very knowledgeable person, Ganesha Lingam, and understands what's going on in the modern world in Saivism, would naturally comment on it in that way, that, you know, we're off track here. We're not following what Duryodhana Sambandar said. We're giving acknowledgement, we're singing his songs, but we're not following what they tell us to do, which is, you know, the worship should be to Shiva. Then that protects you. You don't have to worship the planet. So that's an aside, but it's a fun one. Give me 14 minutes. Okay, the fifth one is the one we'll skip. This is the sixth one. Okay, well, let's go to the eighth one. I think it's about the right length of time. Gurudeva says that the conquest of karma is through regular sadhana. I request Bodhinala to elaborate on the important concept. Okay, so we've got two discussions here. What does Gurudeva mean when he says sadhana, and how does it differ from, say, just going to the temple once in a while, or basic Hindu practices? Gurudeva's use of the word sadhana.
Daily worship.
Daily, yes, okay, daily. Some kind of daily practice is important. What else?
Same time.
Okay. What else?
It should include puja, japa, meditation.
Mm-hmm. Right, so we're talking about the daily sadhana vigil. Performing a daily sadhana vigil is a core aspect of Gurudeva's concept of sadhana. In fact, sometimes when he uses the word sadhana, that's what he means. He says sadhana, but he means the daily sadhana vigil. And so it's such an important part of sadhana to him that he uses it synonymously in his writings. Not always, but synonymously. What else is important about sadhana? How does it differ just from going to the temple regularly? Yes.
The repetition of discipline.
Mm-hmm. Right, you're doing the same thing over and over. Yes.
Regulated penance,
yes, penance is part of it. What else?
Karma yoga?
Well, karma yoga doesn't really fit in this what we're developing. It's important. but it's a little different. What else?
Scriptural study. Scriptural study and studying master course.
Mm-hmm. There's another aspect to it altogether that we're not.
Finding the deities and inner awareness of the presence of the deities, in other words, a conscious connection.
That part of it.
Practicing what you do and practicing the affirmations.
Mm-hmm.
It's that the instructions are given by the guru and you.
Living 24/7.
That's getting closer to what I'm looking for.
Bringing forth one's inner being.
Mm-hmm. It's over there, yes.
Well, I think it's a stepping stone, a little at a time, a little at a time, until it builds up.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're trying to make some kind of progress here. You're not trying to just do the same thing every day and. You know, 50 years later, you're the same person, right? There's this idea of making progress, or you know, it's like exercising to build muscle. You're trying to, there's a goal there. You're not just exercising every day for the sake of exercising. You have a goal. You're trying to increase your muscle mass, for example. Or you're trying to increase your stamina. Well, what we're doing this to increase our control over awareness, we could say that way. We're doing this to improve our control of the instinctive and intellectual mind. You know, we're doing it to be more spiritual. You know, that those are the results we're looking for. By repeating the same thing over and over again, we're trying to improve. You know, it's the example I give, you know, sometimes that's in the efforts to improve, individuals set the goal too high. Mm-hmm. We had an argument, we failed. No, one argument, we failed. You know, doesn't matter that they used to argue every month and now they argue once a year, you know. But they're looking at it, not supposed to argue at all somehow. Going from one argument a month to no arguments might be setting the goal too high. So what we're looking for is improvement. And if we fall short, I don't want to say failure, if we fall short, because failure, you know, really, that doesn't help your self-image. If you say you failed, that's not good for self-concept. We made a mistake. Well, that's a better one. But we can learn from our mistakes, right? And try not to do it the next time around. Well, the idea is improvement in various aspects of our life. We're trying to make our life more spiritual. We're trying to improve in these various ways. You know, it's all different ways of saying the same thing. I stress to the monks, or meditation isn't just, you know, we sit here for an hour in the morning and meditate. That's not, meditation doesn't stop when you go out the door, then throughout the day you need to control awareness. So I say meditation is controlling awareness throughout the day, not just during the hour meditation period. That's what meditation is, because we're not supposed to distinguish the inner from the outer. It's a Western concept, but that's a long talk in itself.
We like it.
Could do that one tomorrow if we run out of topics here tomorrow. But that's the idea of sadhana. The sadhana is the daily sadhana vigil is the core practice, but there's a endeavor to improve that goes with it. To improve in these various ways we've described improvement. And that's someone who's doing that, Red David says they're on the path of, what is it, path of personal transformation? What's on our renewal form, something like that? Upper right-hand corner, path, sadhana, marga, the path of personal transformation. So that's the idea, is that there's not a huge emphasis on study. You know, we need clear intellectual knowledge of what we're doing, but it's the self-effort that transforms us over time, and we're striving for improvement, not perfection. We're striving for improvement. As long as improvement is there, then we need to be content. Because if we're not content, it's creating an obstacle in our own progress. Because if anyone was perfect, they wouldn't have been born in the first place. Right? The fact that we're all here shows at least one thing was not yet perfect. Many more. At least one. So we came back to work on that one. And maybe some others. Okay, that's the first one. Second one, in what way does regular sadhana influence karma? Does regular sadhana influence karma? If so, how?
It comes smoother rather than...
Yes, it comes more smoothly, yes.
For holding ourselves accountable, everything you said for sadhana, you're kind of holding yourself accountable for the day before, or whatever, you know.
Right, you're more willing to accept what happens as your own creation.
Right.
Right. And therefore, we acquiesce. Yes.
In the knowledge that we gain both from reading and that comes from within during our meditations in our regular sadhana, our beliefs improve, and that improves our reactions to things, which then improves our
time. Yes, right, we're changing, and our beliefs and understandings are getting closer to what they should be. Yes.
Sometimes, like when we perform sadhana, challenges come along, like mind sickness or something happens that puts a blockade or a challenge to your daily sadhana. And what is your advice in that regard to handle that situation?
Well, we have to regroup afterwards. You know, things when life really gets way too busy or way too problematic, then the sadhana will fall away for a while, but the important thing is to not let it fall away longer than it needs to. You know, you regroup afterwards and start over again. It's just like an exercise program. You know, things come up, you're really good, you know, half an hour a day, every day, hour a day, and then the routine gets all off for some reason. So then you have to start over and build back up to where you were. But it's that speed with which you start over is the key thing, and that's the advantage of being having a group, you know, associating with a group who's doing sadhana, because it's hard to start over if no one else you know is doing sadhana. It's easy to let it go, and you know, so much easier to not get up an hour earlier and do your sadhana and then to sleep in. Sleep in is a lot easier. I sure need that extra hour of sleep. Okay, so let's see what the answers are. Eighth answer. Religious duties versus sadhana. Living with Shiva Gurudeva says, when we study and practice our religion, we are not necessarily performing deep sadhana. We are simply dispatching our religious duties. These duties are concisely outlined in the Panchanicha Karmas, the five minimal religious obligations of Hindus. Elsewhere it says, the performance of personal sadhana, discipline for self-transformation, is one step deeper in making religion real in one's life. Through sadhana, we learn to control the energies of the body and nerve system. And we experience that through the control of the breath. And we experience that through the control of the breath, the mind becomes peaceful. Sadhana is practiced in the home, in the forest, by a flowing river, under a favorite tree, in the temple, in gurukulas, or whatever, or wherever a pure, serene atmosphere can be found. A vrata, vow, is often taken before serious sadhana is begun. The vrata is a personal pledge between oneself, one's guru, and the angelic beings of the inner world to perform the disciplines regularly, conscientiously, at the same time, each day. I think we hit all those points, didn't we, in our discussion. It summarizes them nicely. And part of the reason this is here is so you can remember. Otherwise, you go away, and if it wasn't written down, it'd be hard to remember a month from now what we were talking about. It's a reference to back up the verbal statements. Thank you. Okay, and all that was covered. This is a nice statement by Adi Shankara. There's an insight section on sadhana in the next Hinduism Today, January issue. This is a quote from it. That benefit, which is superseded by no other benefit, that joy, which is superseded by no other joy, that knowledge, which is superseded by no other knowledge, the attainment of that bliss comes through sadhana. Okay. That's motivating. I'll put that up on your wall. And there's some definitions of sadhana that from the insight section. Sadhana means to achieve by effort. Sadhana refers to disciplines undertaken to reach a specific spiritual goal. Steady and persevering practice of a method or exercise prescribed for spiritual ends. By disciplining your mind, body, and emotions through sadhana, you come more and more into the inner knowing of yourself. Okay, that's consistent with what we said. Then this is the daily sadhana vigil. Living with Shiva says, yes, sadhana begins in the home and it begins with you. It must be practiced regularly at the same time each day, not 2 hours one day, 1 hour the next, and then forgetting about it for 3 or 4 days because you are too busy with external affairs, but every day at the same time. Meeting disappointment with yourself is in itself a sadhana. In the technological age, nearly everyone finds it difficult to set 1 hour aside in which to perform sadhana. So this is the, in Living with Shiva, Guru Deva just suggests half an hour to start with, but in the sutras he outlines it for an hour. We're trying to get someone to start here with an easy statement. That is why in your sadhana vrata or vow, you promise to dedicate only half an hour a day. In the agricultural era, it was easy to find time to perform sadhana 2 or 3 hours a day. Why? The demands of external life were not as great as they are now in the technological age. Half an hour a day, therefore, is the amount of time we dedicate for our sadhana. In the Adinatha Sutras, Gurudeva is more demanding for Shishya and states that the vigil should be 1 hour. Worshippers of Shiva perform a 1 hour daily vigil, ideally before sunrise, in a clean, quiet place, after bathing and donning fresh clothing and holy ash. This vigil is optional on weekends and when traveling or ill. Worshippers of Shiva during their daily sadhana vigil conduct or attend puja, chant the guru mantra and the 108 repetitions of their mantra, study scripture and perform hatha yoga, concentration and meditation. Okay, that was the first part. What is sadhana and how does it differ from just simple Hindu practices? Okay, this is the second part, talking about how sadhana impacts karma. This is on the website, an audio file with a transcript. We were talking yesterday about karma. There is big confusion about fate and karma. Karma is not fate, and fate is not karma. Fate is predestined action caused by something else. So that's the Western idea of fate. You haven't created it. The word fate means it's been created not by you, but it's going to happen to you. Fate is predestined action caused by something else. You have no control of it. It actually comes from the Abrahamic religions, not from Sanatana Dharma. Karma, you do have control of it. You actually do, because Dharma is the controlling element of karma. Right action, right speech, right thought controls karma. Even the worst kinds of karma that you have created in the past and are now facing in the future can be mitigated. That means not actually eliminated, but eliminated enough so that they are gentle karmas rather than rough karmas, as they could have been if they were not mitigated through prayaschitta, which is penance, and through sadhana, which is performing a religious practice at the same time every day. Right action, that means doing kindly things, not mean things. Right speech, that means no backbiting. Right thought, no sexual fantasies, no mental arguments, no plans to hurt somebody behind their back or to their face. Because what you think you might like to do to someone else, you are doing that to yourself through somebody else at some future time. That is the way it works, and that is the way it works. That's the way of emphasizing it. Most importantly, daily sadhana harnesses the instinctive intellectual mind and opens the door to superconsciousness. The key of proper sadhana is that, and you only have to remember one thing only, that it is performed at the same time. The exact time. No fudging, no telling yourself, I can't do my sadhana, it's 6 o'clock, I have to do it at 7. It doesn't work that way. The same time every day creates a habit pattern within the subconscious mind that is indelibly impressed there, and that offers great control of the instinctive mind. Great control of the intellectual mind. Your instinctive mind and your intellectual mind are your tools of the soul to function on planet Earth and as you sleep at night on the astral plane. Well, that's worth a comment. Tools. Gurudev even says the intellectual mind is the greatest barrier to the superconscious also, right? And here he's saying it's a tool of the soul. How can both be right? Well, it's similar to a computer. What's a computer? A computer is whatever you make of it, right? It can be the greatest barrier to your whole life if you end up misusing it. Or if you're using it in the way you should, it can make your job much more efficient. So if it's a tool to you and not a toy, you know, and not something you're using, they're two different things. So the intellect is the same way. You want it to be a tool, just like a computer. You turn it on, you turn it off. Okay, I need my intellect on to solve this problem. It requires some computation here. My intuition may not give me the right answer. So, turn on your intellect, do your computation, you turn it off. You know, it shouldn't dominate us all the time, which it tends to dominate us. Likewise, the instinctive mind. Okay, I'm going to digest my lunch. Fortunately, we don't have to do it with our conscious mind. In fact, I'm surprised we can digest so many diverse types of food at the same time. Cows eat grass, you know, that's all they can do. They eat one food, but you know, we throw 10 different kinds of food down there and expect the instinctive mind to handle it. So instinctive mind is a tool of the soul. It keeps the body functioning when it's right, but we don't want it to dominate the soul. So it's an important little point there that can be thought about. So this is for cyberspace. Remember, they used to get questions in. That's what cyberspace means. People used to write in questions, and then he would answer them at the Sun-One talk. So it was just starting. So he calls that cyberspace. If all of you in cyberspace who have been tuning in over 59 countries, if you are performing sadhana, and if you are performing sadhana now and again, here and there, different times during the day, get it regulated so that it is a daily practice at the same time every day, preferably in the early morning. I mean, you have nothing to do in the early morning. Get out of bed, take a bath, perform your sadhana. You've got the alarm clock to tell you to get out of bed. Get your willpower to get you out of that bed and take a bath and perform the sadhana. No excuses in the morning. Be sure that it is the same time every morning without fail. Now, if you don't want to do sadhana on Saturday and Sunday and sleep in, that's all right. But Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, same time every day. So you can see Gurudev was very consistent in the way he describes it. And here, the idea is mitigation. He's telling us that the practice of sadhana won't get rid of the karma. It's not a strong enough practice to burn it away. It's not intense. Anything we do every day isn't intense. We can't sustain something intense every day. You know, we can only generate intensity now and then in a religious way. Even monastics, they can't sustain intensity every single day unless they're maybe an older person. You can get intense now and then, but otherwise you have to drop back to a more normal practice. So sadhana, when it's done every day, is not intense enough to get rid of the karma. The only thing we talked about so far that will get rid of the karma is the grace of the deity. When it's through intense worship, you get a big blast of the grace of the deity. It can actually eliminate the karma. Otherwise, we're just mitigating it. We're making it flow more smoothly, as you said. You know, it's not as rough. It doesn't disrupt our life. It's not as bad an event, so to speak. Okay, so this is a little more. Molten. However, it must be understood that your past negative karma can be altered into a smoother, easier state than the loving heart chakra nature. Through the loving heart chakra nature, through dharma and sadhana. That is the key of karmic wisdom. Live religiously well, and you will create positive karma for the future and soften negative karma of the past. Right knowledge, right decision, and right action imperceptibly straighten out, unkink, and unwind ignorantly devised or contrived past actions. Key word is reform. Reform, remake, recast. To put into a molten state and be reformed is what happens to our karma when we enter dharma. Our dharma is creating karma, good, not so good, terrible, mixed and confused. Dharma reforms all of this, reshapes it and molds, allowing the devotee to do good and think good, to be clearly perceptive. Putting all the karma in a molten state is bhakti. Happy karma, sad karma, bad karma, when consciously or unconsciously wanted to be held onto, inhibits bhakti. Bhakti brings grace, and the sustaining grace melts and blends the karmas in the heart. In the heart chakra, the karmas are in a molten state. The throat chakra molds the karmas through sadhana, regular religious practices. The third eye chakra sees the karmas past, present, and future as a singular oneness. And the crown chakra absorbs, burns clean enough of the karmas to open the gate, the door of Brahman, revealing the straight path to merging with Shiva. So that doesn't all have to make 100% sense, but the idea is that as we awaken these higher chakras through our practice of sadhana, that's actually changing the karmas. Just as if you were taking objects, melting them, and putting them into new objects. And then the crown chakra can actually get rid of the object. But that's intensity again in another form. So that's how it looks from Gurudeva's point of view. It's the energies released from the higher chakras into the external consciousness, that one of the ways they affect us is remolding the karma. It doesn't get rid of it usually, it just mitigates it, makes it flow out more easily. Okay, conquest of karma, there's a story here. Most of you have heard the story. But it makes the point. Conquest of karma lies in intelligent action and dispassionate reaction. Intelligent action is easier, actually. Intelligent action means something new we're doing is well conceived. It's conceived based upon correct belief. Correct belief in that if we harm others, we're going to harm ourselves. If we help others, we're going to help ourselves. So you know, that's easier to do because we're the one generating the action. But when actions happen to us, what we do is reaction. We're responding. So Gurudeva is saying we need a dispassionate reaction. Or reaction free from retaliation. Reaction free from retaliatory sense or emotion, a reaction which is willing to accept what happened is our karma. And ideally, even forgive the person who's the channel for that. And it's one thing not to, if somebody hits you, you don't hit them back. You know, that's good. But if you want to hit them back, you know, that's not perfect. So, you know, not hitting them back is a good dispassionate reaction first step, but not wanting to hit them back is the goal we're striving for. We don't want to retaliate. The sense of retaliation ideally isn't there, because if there's a sense of retaliation, that means part of us doesn't accept the fact that we created this. Part of us thinks the other person is at fault. But the point is, if it wasn't that person, it would be another person. The person is really the channel. You know, it's that idea of don't shoot the messenger. You know, if it wasn't that messenger bringing the bad news, it would be another one. Oh, you know, it's got to be some messenger in the old days. So in this case, the karma has to come back to us almost always through another person. It's rare for karma not to come through another person, and that's why, you know, interacting with people is an important part of making progress. Most people can't lock themselves up in a cave and make the spiritual progress you think they could. Why? Because the karma doesn't have a chance to come. You know, they don't have a chance to dispassionately react. It's putting things on hold. And it's not going to happen in their mind. You know, it takes a certain nature to make spiritual progress in the cave. Most of us, we need reaction. You know, and that's the other part that we didn't touch on. You know, we talked about the world being an ashram. What do we need to do in the world in order to make spiritual progress, to really use it as an ashram? And we said fulfill dharma, resolve karma, and be of service. Those are the three things. So this is the resolve karma one we're touching on. So being out in the world is an opportunity to resolve our karma. In other words, we come into life with 100 prabdha karmas. Someone mistreats us, we're down to 99. And then if we retaliate, guess what? We're back up to 100, right? That doesn't make any sense from a scorekeeping point of view. From an emotional point of view, it really feels good, you know. But it's, you know, they say that joy, it's in the Quran, the joy of retaliation lasts for a day, but the something lasts forever, you know, when you don't retaliate. So it's human nature to want to retaliate, to feel you should. You know, if I don't retaliate, I'm not upholding the honor of my family. You know, but that's missing the point. That's why we have police. That's why we have principals at school, you know. There's a way of retaliating where you're not doing it personally. You're using the system. And if you use the system to retaliate, then there's no karma. You know, if the kids at school beat up on your son, you don't tell the son, well, you beat them up, you know. No, the son has to be told to talk to the teacher, talk to the principal, and fix it that way. Because retaliation just creates a new problem. So that's the idea there. Conquest of karma lies in intelligent action and dispassionate reaction. Okay, so we kind of did what's here, paraphrased it all. So sadhana, as it says here, the last line, gives us greater control over our emotions, instinctive mind, and thus lessens our chances of retaliating. And the beliefs reinforce that we're not supposed to. You know, we're not supposed to harm others. It creates a karma. There's no way of retaliating without creating a karma.
Could you explain, say you react to a karma came to you, you didn't at the beginning didn't accept it or didn't get it and you had a reaction. But if it kept coming at you and you eventually stopped reacting and seeing this within you and does it resolve or do all those reactions you had before you looked at it?
Well, it resolves if you don't retaliate. I mean, it's gone if you don't retaliate.
And when you finally stop
But if you hold a resentment, then that's a new problem. More subtle problem. It's not a karma. The karma's gone. But now you have a resentment in your mind. And we don't want resentment in our mind. The more resentment we have, the less place there is for devotion. You know, it's only, we're filling up our mind with resentment instead of filling up our mind with devotion. So, and also, there's a practical point, Gurudeva says, is the karma won't go back on the other person until you stop resenting. So, if you really want them... I'm not going to retaliate. I'll just let the law of karma take care of it. Anyway, that's what he says. So. I don't know if it's supposed to be a motivator or just a counter. Does that make sense? There's two different things. Yeah. So anyway, back here, karma management first principle. And the cowboy and Indian, that's the way we used to do it in old days. You know, the classic movie would be someone kills your brother and then you spend the rest of the movie tracking them down and kill them, right?
How much hours of that?
You know, I don't know, it's so boring, you know? So obviously when you kill them, you create a new karma and then the whole thing starts over again. Just,
the sequel.
Yeah, the sequel, right. So you're just creating reruns after reruns, you know, and since remakes after remakes, I guess, of the same plot. By retaliating. So the point is, you know, as we said, you don't want to do nothing, but you, in that scenario, you have to involve the sheriff. You know, it's the sheriff's job. He's taken an oath to only use violence if necessary. But he tries to catch the person and bring them to justice. So you use the system. You don't want to do nothing. You want to respond, protect your family, respond to the honor of your family, and so forth, but utilizing the system in a way that doesn't create any karma. To crawl. So this is the point I made, yes, it's actually easier to do this one, intelligent action. Fifth principle, create no negative karmas. Once we really understand the law of karma, and it's a belief that really reflects who we are, it's not just something in our mind, but it reflects who we are, then there's a strong, natural, strong tendency to do the right thing. As Gurudeva says, wise handling of karma begins with the decision to carry the karma and now cheerfully and not add to it. Firm decision to live in such a way as to create no new negative karmas is a sound basis for living a religious life, for following the precepts of Dharma and avoiding that which is adharmic. So that's the point, and it's actually easier to do than not reacting. Because reacting, our emotions get stirred. And when we have a sense of pride and so forth, saving face and all of that comes up. Whereas when we're just acting, it's easier to be calm and do the right thing. Okay, well let's take a look here. 36 minutes. That's a long one. It's got two parts to it, that's all the line. Well, thank you very much. We have 5, 6, and 7 are left, right? Om Sahana Bhavatu.
Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.